It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson for Kate Archer Kent. This Friday was supposed to be the first all-female spacewalk in history, but due to a spacesuit sizing issue, it's not happening. While women have been part of the space program for decades, NASA didn't send women into space until 1983, a full 25 years after the agency was founded, and a full two decades after the Soviet Union launched the first female cosmonaut. But NASA was surprisingly progressive for its time, banning hiring discrimination long before the Equal Employment Opportunity Act. So why, we wondered, did it take so long to get the first U.S. female astronaut into space? That's one of the questions we'll answer as we delve into the history of women at NASA, women like Peggy Whitson, who holds the U.S. record for time in space.
I watched the astronauts walk on the moon when I was 9. When I graduated high school, they picked the first female astronauts. I got a bachelor's and a PhD and spent 10 years applying to be an astronaut.
How many of you recognize Peggy Whitson's name? Do you remember when Sally Ride became the first American woman in space? Are you a woman in the STEM field? Has your gender shaped your experiences? And how has your gender shaped your experiences as it did for the first female astronauts? What do you remember about the first American women going into space? 800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Amy Foster is an associate professor of history at the University of Central Florida. She's the author of Integrating Women into the Astronaut Corps, Politics and Logistics at NASA, 1972 to 2004. Amy, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you very much.
Well, this Friday was supposed to be the first all-female spacewalk in history. Two women were scheduled to walk together in space outside the International Space Station. But NASA ran into a somewhat basic issue, spacesuit sizes. Both astronauts would have needed to wear a medium-sized torso component, but only one of those is readily available at the space station. What was your reaction when you heard this, Amy?
Well, I was disappointed. This was one of those moments that as historians, we kind of gravitate to. We look for those firsts. And with the history of the U.S. space program, during the space race, it was all about those firsts, about beating the Soviets to doing something first. And so this would have been monumental because it's not that often that a woman gets to do a spacewalk to begin with. And the idea that two would be doing it at the same time was exciting for at least historians like me, but I think other women who and girls who look to these women as examples and their heroes. So it is disappointing.
Anne McLean and Christina Koch would have been the 12th and 13th women ever to do a spacewalk and the first to do it together. Was the planned spacewalk, was this intentional on NASA's part?
No, a spacewalk, they're happening pretty much all the time with some regularity. And most of the time, we're not really aware that they're even going on. So work on the International Space Station, there's always upkeep that you need to do. I mean, we can go out and mow our grass, but without much issue. But it takes a little more work to keep the International Space Station running. I haven't talked to anybody at NASA, but I have to assume it's simply just part of the rotation. That's usually how it works. There's a spacewalk that I believe is happening today or tomorrow that Anne was doing. So it's the idea of using both of the two people who were doing the spacewalk right now, again on Friday. It's just about giving somebody rest because a spacewalk is actually a fairly taxing experience. It's a lot of work to work in one of those spacesuits. So I'm sure it is just coincidence, the fact that we have two women up on the International Space Station right now who are both trained to do spacewalks. I would imagine it was just simply part of the rotation and it was going to happen. Unfortunately, now that we don't have spacesuits, that's not going to happen.
Well, NASA sent its first female astronaut into space in 1983, more than two decades after the agency was founded and long after the Soviets had already done it. Why did it take so long for NASA to get to that point?
Well, that was certainly my driving question when I started doing this research. Soviet Union flew Valentina Tereshkova in 1963, and we didn't fly Sally Ride until 1983. And I really was expecting that it took federal pressure for NASA to change their mind about putting women into space. But it's a much more complicated question than that, or answer than that. The Equal Employment Opportunity Act was passed in 1972, and that's the policy that requires federal agencies to meet those same expectations of the Civil Rights Act. But even the sex component of the Civil Rights Act had never been really all of that. It hadn't really been part of the protection. Even the Equal Employment Commission, as part of the Civil Rights Act, was basically told this is about dealing with complaints from black men, not even black women. So that sex component was really not a part of what the Civil Rights Act was doing. But James Webb, who was the director or the NASA administrator in the 1960s, came out with a policy in 1966 before President Johnson even said sex needs to be a part of what we're dealing with the Civil Rights Act. James Webb was saying we will not discriminate based on race, sex, marital status, or country of origin, or the big one that just blew my mind when I read it was physical handicap. And this was in 1966, and the American Disabilities Act isn't passed until 1990. So NASA really was thinking, had some pretty forward-thinking policies in the 1960s. But for me, I think the real question is why doesn't it happen in the 60s and why doesn't it happen before 1983 is that NASA was focused on getting to the moon. In 1963, when the Soviets were sending up a woman, NASA was already entrenched in everything that had to happen to get to the moon. And those technological challenges in the 1960s were pretty daunting. When the Mercury program ended, Gordon Cooper was the last astronaut to fly as part of the Mercury program. His flight lasted about 25 hours, and almost all of the systems in his capsule were dead because the batteries were running out of power after 25 hours. Well, it takes 3 days to get to the moon, and then we have to bring them back. And so even just from a simple technology standpoint of the battery, which we think of as pretty commonplace now, was a technology that had to do significant development before we were going to be able to make it to the moon. So focusing on trying to, refit a capsule to put a woman up in the 60s just to make a political statement wasn't something that NASA was really all that focused on. So it takes the end of the Apollo program and then refocusing on a new flight vehicle that is going to be large enough and capable of dealing with the anatomy of men and women, and that's the shuttle, which gets approval to start construction and development in 1972, and it takes until 1981 for the shuttle to fly. And so as we start rotating astronauts through the program and selection, it's 1983 by the time Sally Ride flies.
Our conversation, Amy Foster, about the history of NASA's female astronauts continues in just a moment. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent.
Everybody wanted to know about what kind of makeup I was taking up. They didn't care about how well prepared I was to operate the arm or deploy communication satellites. Without a doubt, I think the worst question that I have gotten was whether I cried when we got malfunctions in the simulator.
Sally Ride became NASA's first U.S. female astronaut in 1983, a full two decades after the first Soviet female cosmonaut was launched and 25 years after NASA was established. We're talking about the history of U.S. women in space with Amy Foster, an associate professor of history at the University of Central Florida. She's the author of Integrating Women into the Astronaut Corps, Politics and Logistics at NASA, 1972 to 2004. Do you remember when Sally Ride became the first American woman in space? Are you a woman in the STEM field? Has your gender shaped your experiences as it did the first female astronauts? And what do you remember about the first American women going into space? 800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. We're talking with Amy Foster, who is the author of a new book about the history of women in NASA, and wondering what you think about this situation. 800-642-1234. Amy, as those who've seen Hidden Figures may know, NASA actually did hire women and racial minorities, not as astronauts, but in behind-the-scenes roles. You talked a little bit earlier about NASA's views when it came to diversity and inclusion. In this regard, they were way ahead of their time in the mid '60s. What was the driving force for that type of culture, and why didn't that extend into the astronaut program?
Absolutely, it was forward thinking. When I was looking at the policies that James Webb passed in terms of equal employment within NASA, I don't really know what his motives were, but I think the fact that he made such a policy change when it was still some years before that was mandated for federal agencies, it's extraordinary. The work that women were doing at NASA, there certainly were women who were working as secretaries and in what we refer to in history as those pink collar jobs. They were there, but yeah, they absolutely were working as mathematicians, and the term we used for them was calculators. So they are the first calculators. But I think when we look at the history of women in the sciences, women had already had a long presence of working in mathematics and working with astronomical calculations. So it made a lot of sense for NASA to continue to hire these women to do a lot of these calculations for launch and reentry, because they had already been there was this long history of women doing that job, even going back to the NACA, which is the National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics, which was founded in 1915, women were doing calculations in that program. And the NACA is shut down in 1958, essentially is superseded by NASA. So the women who were working for the NACA as calculators are simply kind of shifting over to NASA and doing the same general calculations that they were doing in the NACA. So there's already a long history there.
Okay, so but why not astronauts? I mean, astronauts were chosen basically from the test pilot corps, at which were all men. But mm-hmm. why no women astronauts? Did NASA intend to have female astronauts ever, or what was going on here?
So I think the question that we have to ask about the 60s is, was NASA interested? I think NASA was always looking for, opportunities. I mean, they did have the Apollo program that certainly was a distraction in terms of saying, okay, well, let's stop and put a woman up into space. But there were some medical tests done in the 1960s on women. It makes a lot of sense for NASA to want to put a woman in space from a basic economic and engineering standpoint. So for every pound of cargo that you put into space, and cargo is basically defined as whatever is going to end up in outer space in orbit. So that includes the capsule, all the equipment inside, all the people inside, all the food and water that they need, all the air that they need. That's all cargo. for every 1 pound of cargo, it takes 3 pounds of fuel to get that 1 pound into space. And so if you can reduce the weight of what you're putting into space, then it becomes more cost effective and from an engineering standpoint, easier to get all of that into space. So, and there are limits to the thrust capacity of the fuels that we're using now. And I'm not sure, there's certainly always development on new fuels, but until those new fuels are considered viable options, what we can do in terms of lift capability is fairly limited. So the reason that women make an attractive, you know, option is women tend to be smaller than men. Women weigh less than men. Women drink less water than men. They eat less food than men. And they use less oxygen than men. So all of those things come into that cargo capacity that makes the possibility of putting a woman into space attractive. So the medical tests that were done on the Mercury astronauts were done on a handful of women in the early 1960s. But this was not a NASA program. Literally by 1961, the focus of NASA is to put a man on the moon. And that's about when these medical testings were going on for women. But this was basically the brainchild of General Don Flickinger, who was in the Air Force. He was a flight surgeon, and Dr. Randy Lovelace, who had done all the medical testing for the Mercury astronauts. So they put about 19 women through the first round of medical testing that the Mercury astronauts went through, and 13 of them passed those medical tests, and some of them performed better than the Mercury 7 astronauts. Several of the women went on to phase 2 testing, and one woman went on to phase 3 testing. But that phase 3 testing was done by the Navy. And as more of these women wanted to move on to phase 3 testing, the Navy asked NASA, are you backing this program to put a woman in space? And they said, we're focused on the moon. That's all our attention can be spent on right now. And so they didn't tell the Navy, yeah, run with this. And so the program basically fizzled out. So I think as much as NASA would have been behind the idea of, you know, putting a woman into space at any point, the focus had to be Apollo in the 1960s. And so the focus on putting a woman into space shifts. With the Soviet Union, everything they did in their space program was about prestige. And so it made sense for them to put a woman up before the United States just so they can make that claim. NASA doesn't work under those same principles. It's more about the mission versus the first.
Amy Foster is an associate professor of history at the University of Central Florida. Amy, what was it like for that first group of female astronauts at NASA, and how did having female astronauts change the way things worked there?
It was a new world, I think, for a lot of the men at NASA. I mean, certainly there were these women mathematicians, but at some level, those women were working behind the scenes. So for most of the engineers who were designing the shuttle and designing for women, their interaction with women had largely been kind of that secretarial pool. And so it was very much a culture shock for a number of men at NASA, just because it was such a different, it was such a change to their community to have women who, you know, all had doctorates and were physicians who knew what they were talking about coming in and being just one of the guys. In fact, that was the nickname for the first class of astronauts that included women was the 35 new guys. And so there was a learning curve. And I think that required a fair amount of patience on the part of those first six women. They learned some coping techniques to figure out exactly, you know, what they would do as a group so that engineers wouldn't come along when the second woman flew, who was Judy Resnick, to say, oh, well, she's got to change everything now because she's a woman. So they were very cognizant of the fact that these women were setting precedences.
We've got less than a minute here. Briefly, as we wrap up, what do you think the future is for women in the space program?
Anything they want to do. The future is vast. NASA has grand plans for moving forward, back to the moon, back to Mars. Women are going to be there. They've been in leadership positions at NASA. Clearly, these two women on the International Space Station now, they had high hopes for doing great things. They'll continue to do great things. We'll see women on Mars pretty quickly.
Okay. Amy Foster, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you very much.
Amy Foster is an associate professor of history at the University of Central Florida, and she is also the author of Integrating Women into the Astronaut Corps, Politics and Logistics at NASA, 1972 to 2004. Coming up next, we'll talk about a possible new moon mission for NASA. Stay tuned for that. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. If you were one of the millions of people glued to a television set on July 21st, 1969, you probably felt a chill run down your spine when you heard these words.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Neil Armstrong electrified the entire world with just two sentences. NASA had achieved its goal of putting men on the moon. Do you remember listening to or watching the live broadcasts of the Apollo missions? What was that experience like? And what would it be like for us to return to the moon? Is that something we should do? Is it the best use of our resources? Or should we explore something else? Let us know what you think at 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Basil Hero is a former investigative reporter with NBC News Television and the author of the forthcoming book, The Mission of a Lifetime, Lessons from the Men Who Went to the Moon. Basil, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, John, and thank you for the opportunity to join you and your listeners.
Well, set the scene for us. What was the country like as we prepared to send astronauts to the moon in the 60s to fulfill that famous promise that President Kennedy made?
Well, you really had, I believe, two cultures. You had the 60s revolution, cultural, you know, feminism, the sexual revolution, protests on campus, and that was largely a coastal, bi-coastal phenomenon. If you went into the heartland, it was a much different story, and it was certainly a much different story at NASA, where you had very young engineers. The average age of the people in mission control was 26. That's hard to believe at this point, but that was in fact the case, and they just had their nose to the rail there, and they had one goal, and that was to get to the moon in Kennedy's time frame. You know, by 1968, of course, we had gotten the first Apollo mission to the moon. That was Frank Borman, Jim Lovell, and Bill Anders, and there was the famous Christmas Eve broadcast. So really, there were just two different sides to what was happening in America at that point.
So what were the goals of those early Apollo missions?
Well, they first started, of course, with Mercury and Gemini, and those were the building blocks to Apollo. The key to all of it was orbital rendezvous and docking the command module with another vehicle. In this case, ultimately, it was going to be the lunar lander. So that was really the goal of Mercury and Gemini, and to see how well the astronauts could adapt to space. we just didn't know at that point, which is why we put chimps up in the beginning to see what the effects of zero G would be and whether or not they could operate outside the space capsule. And of course, that told them whether they could, ultimately be able to walk on the moon and survive the atmosphere there.
You refer to the astronauts who landed on the moon as eagles. Why is that?
In my interviews with them, the thing that struck me, John, was their eyes. You can tell a lot about a person by their eyes. And these men are now approaching their 90s. And they still have that alert look, and they are still active and in incredible shape. Borman, who's 90, still flies his vintage planes. Anders, who's 86, same thing. And the eagle was the majestic symbol that they put on, certainly on the Apollo 11 mission patch. And it just struck me that they were, in fact, like eagles, alert, majestic, and they still have that presence, even at this age.
What were the basic qualities that all of these astronauts seemed to share? Where did they come from?
They were mostly from rural backgrounds. There were a couple from privileged backgrounds, like Pete Conrad, who was a Princeton grad, and interestingly, Al Shepard, who is a Mayflower descendant. But by and large, they were kids from farms, struggling, and they succeeded, on their wits and determination. And those really are the major background characteristics. The psychological profiles, of course, showed that they had tremendous self-confidence. Most of them were firstborns. Only 10% of those who were selected came from broken families. So there was a lot of stability there. And the thing that separated them from everyone else was their assessment of calculated risk. We've all, well, not all of us, but many have seen the movie The Right Stuff, which they did not like, and they thought that the book was far more accurate. But they had a very finely tuned appreciation for calculated risk. They were not reckless. They were not fearless. They knew fear. They knew how to conquer it and manage it. And one of the things I discuss in the book is how to conquer one's fear.
Basil Hero is the author of the forthcoming book, The Mission of a Lifetime, Lessons from the Men Who Went to the Moon. What do you want to see when it comes to the future of space exploration? Are you excited by private sector efforts, or are you worried about them? Let us know what you think at 800-642-1234. Basil, in 1968, human perspective about Earth changed with that first Apollo crew leaving Earth's orbit and that iconic photo of the Earth seen from the moon. What was that experience like for us, seeing the Earth, the moon, and how did that change our perspective about Earth?
Well, the irony for the Apollo astronauts, John, was that they went to explore the moon. In fact, what happened is they discovered the Earth. What really caught their attention as they were orbiting the moon was not the moon itself. I mean, obviously they were curious, but as soon as they made their fourth orbit on Apollo 8, up comes the Earth, and it just left them in awe. And you can hear from the transcripts, the wows and the oh my gods. So the Earth itself is what struck them. And from 240,000 miles out, their overriding impression was small and fragile. And then when they returned to a one, the identical conclusion was that we are living in the Garden of Eden on Earth, and we have just failed to realize it.
What about the rest of the world? How did seeing those photographs of our Earth from that distance, how did that change us as humanity?
Well, it helped launch the environmental movement. We had never seen Earth from deep space. And it was quite clear in the 60s and before, starting really in the 19th century, when industrial pollution began. And so there was a recognition that the Earth was precious, but it didn't really hit home until we saw those photos. The other seed that it implanted, John, was this notion that we are one human race, a planetary species, and not, you know, individual ethnic groups. They stopped seeing the Earth in terms of countries, borders, races. It really was an epiphany that struck them all.
And that's kind of ironic, considering the rise of populism and nationalism these days. We seem to really have lost that thing that we learned in 1968 about being an Earth and being the human inhabitants of that Earth. Did that strike you at all?
It did strike me, and there was a fascinating observation by Mike Collins, who was on, you know, Apollo 11 with Aldrin and Armstrong. And when they went on their round the world tour, when they came back, what struck Collins was that everywhere they went, didn't matter, Asia, Africa, Europe, everyone said to them, not you Americans did it, it was we did it. We, humanity, we did it. And it just stunned them to hear the we as opposed to you. And it was just a brief moment in the history, frankly, of the human race, where we all collectively saw the moon landing as a planetary accomplishment.
Did these people, these men who went to the moon, did they think of themselves as heroes?
They did not. And to this day, they do not. And one of the things that they abhor is this notion of inflated heroism and celebrity culture. They just cannot tolerate it. The only one who really is the outlier in all of this is Buzz Aldrin, who has desperately sought attention from the day he landed and came back. But they believe in the common good and in something greater than oneself. You don't hear much about the common good anymore or believing in something greater than oneself, but they cite this as one of the sources of their courage. And I wanted to do a deep dive into this and really do the right stuff 2.0. And when I initially contacted them, they wanted to know, well, what is it that you're doing that hasn't already been done? And when I said that I wanted to touch on the existential questions, that got their attention.
And we will talk about that as our conversation with Basil Hero continues. He's the author of the forthcoming book, The Mission of a Lifetime, Lessons from the Men Who Went to the Moon. What do you want to see when it comes to the future of space exploration? There's time for you to get in on the conversation at 800-642-1234. John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent on The Morning Show. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent.
And from the crew of Apollo 8, we close with good night, good luck, a Merry Christmas, and God bless all of you on the good earth.
Those words in 1968 from the crew of Apollo 8 changed the way, along with a big photograph of the Earth from over 240,000 miles away, changed the way we think about our world. But what is our hope for the future of space exploration? That's what we'd like you to think about this morning. Would you like to see a return to the moon like we had with the Apollo missions? Or is there some better use of our resources to explore space? 800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. Basil Hero is the author of the forthcoming book, The Mission of a Lifetime, Lessons from the Men Who Went to the Moon. Basil, when astronauts did touch the moon's surface, what was the takeaway? What did they learn or realize about Earth standing on the moon?
It was the fragility and the essentially the smallness of the Earth in the solar system. But again, it did give them a newfound appreciation for Earth as the Garden of Eden. And it interestingly, Jim Lovell, you know, who was made famous by Apollo 13, concluded that we don't go to heaven when we die. We go to heaven when we are born. And I was just struck by that. And I called up the dean of the Yale Divinity School and I said, have you ever heard such a statement before? He says, no, I have not. It's a complete transposition of the ascendancy narrative. And Lovell's experience seeing the Earth from the moon is what created that. One of the moonwalkers found Jesus on the moon. Another came back and was convinced that there was a higher power, much in the way of the Force that we read about and hear about in Star Wars. And so they just reframed their view. They said that they went out as engineers and came back as humanitarians.
Once we made it to the moon, though, political and public interest seemed to fade. Why? What was behind that decline in support for missions like Apollo?
Well, we have to remember this was all in the context of the Cold War, beating the Russians to the moon. So really, it was as if we had put ourselves on war footing to get there. And then once we had accomplished it, I think certainly the competitive instinct withered. And then it was a question of how do we reframe our thoughts about space exploration. And it was very expensive. It was $20 billion. And the belief was that to launch the space shuttle, a reusable spacecraft, and then ultimately from that experience, be able to build a spacecraft that would be able to venture out to Mars and elsewhere. So the political and the financial will was simply gone after the moon landing.
And for the men that went to the moon, how did they feel about NASA essentially killing moon missions?
Well, they were distraught, obviously. Their hope was that we would continue returning to the moon and building a lunar base. So here we are 50 years later, and that is precisely what NASA wants to do. And clearly we could have done it if we had continued with the missions. And now we're left in the rather extraordinary position of not having a rocket that's powerful as the Saturn V. We're essentially starting from scratch again.
So we no longer really have the capability to escape the Earth's gravity.
That's correct.
Basil Hero is the author of the forthcoming book, The Mission of a Lifetime, Lessons from the Men Who Went to the Moon. Each president changes the mission of his predecessor in terms of space policy. Now the Trump administration has decided to return to the moon with a request for help from the private sector. How did the Eagles react to hearing this?
They're for it because the truth is that in the 60s, there was a marriage of NASA and the private sector. NASA itself had 36,000 employees, but it subcontracted all of the work out to 400,000 people, engineers, and 20,000 contractors. So that relationship had existed, and they're doing the same again, although they seem to be relying a little bit more on Blue Origin and SpaceX and Bezos and Musk. So they are for it, They have more faith in Bezos and Blue Origin, frankly, than they do in Musk and SpaceX, even though they've had more launches. And it comes down to their perception of the men and their fear of anyone who's a showboater. And so they think Bezos is a safer bet long term.
What are the perceived benefits of going back to the moon for research?
There is helium-3 on the moon, which is the most precious resource that exists. It's now valued at $5 billion per metric ton. It would revolutionize nuclear power, and we would go from fusion or fission to fusion, which is a far more powerful source of nuclear power. And interestingly, the astronauts believe that we should restart our nuclear power industry because they think it is cleaner and a much faster way of satisfying our energy needs.
Given these conversations you've had with these men, what should the future of space exploration look like? What is their hope?
Well, the most interesting comment came from Neil Armstrong, who 2 years before he died said that he believed that we had not evolved enough as a species to colonize the rest of the universe. Essentially, he was saying, look, we've screwed up here on Earth. Until we clean up our act here, what is it that we are going to export to other planets? So he was, in my estimation, what I would like to describe as a quiet genius. He was steeped in the classics. This was not necessarily the case for the other moonwalkers, but they believe that we should, in fact, explore the rest of the universe. They believe that the moon should be the staging area to get to Mars. And of course, the technology that would be required to accomplish this would have the same spin-off benefits, they believe, that we saw in the 1960s from the moonshot.
When you consider the lives of these astronauts, what's the final lesson we should take away today?
I think it's a reminder of quiet patriotism, of humility, of believing in the common good and something greater than oneself, and to appreciate the planet and remember that as we now know, it really is the only planet in the universe that has the ingredients for life. We've just not seen it anywhere else, and we need to realize that this is the Garden of Eden, and we need to take care of it. That's their message. That's the lesson.
Thank you, Basil Hero, for joining us today. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Basil Hero is a former investigative reporter with NBC News television stations. He's also the author of the book, The Mission of a Lifetime, Lessons from the Men Who Went to the Moon, which comes out next week. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent.